For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right. In this section of Acts, plus the one we just finished last week, there are no fewer than five different trials that Paul goes on, each one recounted in varying levels of detail by the author, although this whole part, you know, has way more detail than most of Acts because Luke is actually present and sees these things with most of them with his own eyes. Now, each time Paul is put on trial, he tries to work the good news about Jesus in, you know, because he sees this as an opportunity to get the word out there. People respond in different ways. So we'll try to detect that. You got to kind of read between the lines, you know, because these are summaries that we're reading. You know, I mean, even if you have a 20-verse description of Paul's defense, you could read that whole thing, you know, in 5 minutes. And I'm sure that he was up there for longer than that. So, I mean, these are summaries that are giving us an idea of what he said. You kind of have to sense what the full, you know, story would have been. Now, last time, if you were here, we had Paul had been swarmed by this mob in Jerusalem that were pounding him and trying to beat him to death. And the Roman soldiers had stormed in, parted through the crowd, seized him, and had to carry him out on their shoulders to get him out of this mob. People, you know, throwing dirt in the air. Remember that scene? And they took him to the Antonio Fortress, which is right off the temple. I mean, it literally adjoined one edge of the temple grounds there. That's where the Roman barracks, and it was a fortress, was. And they had him in there as a prisoner. So we're going to start in actually the last verse in 22. Says, the next day, the commander ordered the leading priests into session with the Jewish high council. He wanted to find out what the trouble was all about, so he released Paul to have him stand before them. So the commander still can't figure out why they're pissed at Paul. You know, he kept asking them, what did he do? And then all the shouting and stuff, and he's like, he can't figure out what he's done. So here's Paul now standing in front of the Sanhedrin, the high ruling council in Israel, and all of the high priests and everyone are there. And so he stands up and began, brothers, I've always lived before God with a clear conscience. Instantly, Ananias, the high priest, commanded those close to him to slap him on the mouth. But Paul said to him, God will slap you, you corrupt hypocrite. What kind of judge are you to break the law yourself by ordering me struck like that? And those standing near Paul said to him, do you dare to insult God's high priest? And he kind of looks around and says, oh. He says, I'm sorry, brothers. I didn't realize he was the high priest. For the scriptures say, you must not speak evil of any of your rulers. I guess either Ananias wasn't wearing his priest outfit there, or we know Paul's eyesight was apparently bad, according to Galatians 5. But anyway, Luke kind of skips to the end. He doesn't really give the rest of Paul's speech in this one. But then looking around the room, Paul realizes that some members of the high council were Sadducees and some were Pharisees. So he shouted, he deliberately sets them against each other. He shouted, brothers, I'm a Pharisee, as were my ancestors, and I am on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead. And so when he said this divided the council, the Pharisees against the Sadducees. The Sadducees say there is no resurrection or angels or spirits. They're like liberal theologians today. They don't really believe in the supernatural. Like deists, they believe in a God who's out there but not involved in any way in what's going on. Whereas the Pharisees believe in all of these. And so there occurred a great uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisee party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, we find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him. That story he told might be true. As the conflict grew more violent, the commander The Roman guy was afraid they would tear Paul apart. And so he has to again order his soldiers to go in and rescue him by force and take him back to the fortress. And so here comes a wedge of Roman soldiers pushing through the crowd and taking him and back in there. It's really funny in a way. I'm sure it wasn't funny at the time at all. But so Lysias, who's the name of this commander, he still doesn't know what it's about. He still can't figure out why people are upset at Paul. It's also clear by now, when you see how things work here, Paul's never going to get a fair trial in Jerusalem. They're rioting and they're going to tear him to pieces, and he never even got started. He didn't even get to start, give his speech hardly. And that becomes significant later in the story. That night, the Lord appeared to Paul and said, "Be encouraged, Paul, just as you have been a witness for me here in Jerusalem, you now must preach the good news in Rome as well." And so from now on, Paul knows where this is all headed, is that he's headed to Rome. The next morning, a group of Jews got together and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 of them in the conspiracy. They went to the leading priests and elders and said, "We bound ourselves with an oath to eat nothing till we killed Paul." And they said, "So you guys, the high council, should ask the commander to bring Paul back to the council again. Pretend you want to examine his case more fully, and we'll kill him on the way. We'll wait with the ambush, jump the party, waste." But Paul's nephew, his sister's son, heard of their plan and went to the fortress and told Paul. Whoa. I didn't even know Paul had a sister. She's never mentioned anywhere else. He's got a sister living there in Jerusalem. This is her son. This kid must be a kid, because later they describe leading him by the hand and stuff. It sounds like he's either it sounds like he's maybe 10 or 12. The word used for him, young man, could mean like a 10, 12-year-old, something like that, or maybe 14. Paul called for one of the Roman officers. So he gets in to visit Paul, tells him what he's just heard. Paul calls the commander over and says, "Take this young man to commander. He has something important to tell him." So the officer did, explaining to Lysias, to the commander, "Paul, the prisoner, called me over and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you." The commander took his hand and led him aside. And he says, "What do you want to tell me?" Paul's nephew told him, "Some Jews are going to ask you to bring Paul before the high council tomorrow, pretending they want to get some more information." He says, "But don't do it. There are more than 40 men hiding along the way, ready to ambush him. They have vowed not to eat or drink anything until they've killed him. They're ready now, just waiting for your consent." And so the commander says, don't let anyone know that you told me this. And he warns him. Now the commander called to his officers. He ordered, "Get 200 soldiers ready to leave for Caesarea." So they're Jerusalem, kind of in the middle of the country, middle south, up on a mountain range. It's pretty high elevation, 2,500 feet. They're going to go down to the coast road, and somewhat north of modern Tel Aviv is where Caesarea was. That was the big Roman city that had been built there by Herod the Great. And that's where the seat of government was for the province. And so you're going to take him down. You're leaving at 9 o'clock tonight, so they're going to make it a nighttime exit. Also take 200 spearmen and 70 mounted troops. So there's 470. That's a sizable guard. He's not taking any chances. Provide horses for Paul to ride and get him safely to Governor Felix. Then he wrote this letter to the governor. Take this letter down with you. "From Claudius Lysias to His Excellency Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by some Jews, and they were about to kill him when I arrived with the troops. When I learned that he was a Roman citizen, I removed him to safety." You know, Lysias is putting the best face on. He doesn't mention that he bound him with chains or that he stretched him out for torture, which would have gotten him in trouble. He kind of makes himself sound like, I rescued this Roman. He didn't even know he was a Roman citizen when he did this, but So he's kind of putting a little spin job on here. Then I took him to their high council to try to learn the basis of the accusations against him. I soon discovered the charge was something regarding their religious law. Certainly nothing worthy of imprisonment or death. But when I was informed of a plot to kill him, I immediately sent him to you. I've told his accusers to bring their charges down before you. Well, when they arrived in Caesarea, they presented Paul and the letter to Governor Felix. 5 days later, down comes Ananias. So he tells the guys up in Jerusalem, if you want to get him, you're going to have to go and do it in Caesarea. So they did. They sent a posse down. They got the high priest and a bunch of others, this lawyer, Tertullus. And they get up to present their case, and they have a trial. Well, Tertullus spends a few verses butt-kissing to Felix, which we'll skip over and get right to his case. He says, we have found this man to be a troublemaker who is constantly stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He's a ringleader of the cult known as the Nazarenes. Furthermore, he was trying to desecrate the temple when we arrested him. Okay, so you have three distinct charges being leveled here. Stirring up riots, not allowed. That would be considered sedition, and it was a capital offense. The Romans are very tough on riots. He's saying he's a ringleader of this cult and implying that he's starting a new religion. Also not allowed. And it makes him, I'm sure, sound menacing. And finally, that he tried to desecrate the temple, which was also against Roman law. Desecrate places of worship. And so they've got three distinct charges that they're leveling. Of course, when we arrested him, he makes it sound like we put him under arrest, when in fact, as we saw, it was a lynch mob is what it was. He says, you can find out the truth of our accusations by examining him yourself. Then the other Jews all chimed in, declaring that everything Tertullus said was true. All right, the governor then motioned Paul to speak. And Paul said, I know, sir, you've been a judge of Jewish affairs for many years, so I gladly present my defense before you. He says, you can quickly discover that I arrived in Jerusalem no more than 12 days ago to worship at the temple. So there's not a large scope of things to study here. This has all happened within a few days. Before that went even around. My accusers never found me arguing with anyone in the temple or stirring up a riot in any synagogue or on the streets of the city. These men cannot prove the things they accuse me of doing. He says, now I admit that I follow the way. That was their term for Christianity. In fact, this is the term used way more than any other in the New Testament. You know, the word Christian is only used once in describing us as Christians. In the book of 1 Peter, he says, if you suffer as a Christian. That's the only time it's ever used. Christian was not a word that Christians came up with. Christian was a derogatory description. It means little Christs, miniature Christs. And it was come up with by the enemies of the Christians themselves referred to themselves as the way. The way of Jesus, which they call a cult. Of course, in the Christians' own view, they were Jews. They were following Judaism properly understood. They didn't see this as any new religion or anything else. This is exactly what came right out of the Old Testament, which had always predicted the coming of the Messiah. And so he didn't see. He says, "I worship the God of our ancestors, and I firmly believe the Jewish law and everything written in the prophets." He says, "I'm squarely within the mainstream of Judaism, which was a Roman allowed religion." He says, "I have the same hope in God as any of these men have, that He will raise both the righteous and the unrighteous." Because of this, I always try to maintain a clear conscience before God and before all people. After several years away, I returned to Jerusalem with money to aid my people and to offer sacrifices to God. My accusers saw me in the temple as I was completing the purification ceremony. There was no crowd around me. There was no rioting. True. That's right. Remember, it was just some guys that said, hey, that's him. But he hadn't caused a riot or anything. But he says some Jews from the province of Asia were there, and they ought to be here to bring charges if they have anything against me. A key point in Roman law, which is that you had the right to face your accusers. And he says, where are these people? Because, of course, they've probably gone back home by now, where they live up in Asia. And these were the ones that had accused him to the others there, and they weren't in the trial. They weren't in the room, so there were no witnesses present. Everyone was hearing this. All the evidence against him was coming in secondhand, hearsay. At that point, Felix, who was quite familiar with the way, adjourned the hearing and said, wait until Lysias, the garrison commander, arrives, then I'll decide this case. And he ordered an officer to keep Paul in custody, but to give him some freedom and to allow his friends to visit him and take care of his needs. Well, there was a big Roman fortress there, so he probably had the run of that whole area. And the fact that his friends are able to come in and visit him, they could bring him food, they could bring him like bedding, clothing, money to give to guards or whatever. I mean, this was a really pretty good treatment. And for us, very important, because this is what now allowed Luke to confer with Paul on the writing of this book that we're reading and the other book he wrote, which is the book of Luke. Compare the first opening verses of Luke and Acts, and you'll realize this is the same author writing to this most excellent Theophilus. And it's written, most of it, right during this time, right here. Basically, while Paul's waiting for these interminable trials that goes on for a long time, Luke had nothing else to do, so he spent that time doing research. He says, I interviewed everyone, I've talked to everyone involved, I've read all of the accounts. And based on that, here's what I've learned, and he writes his books. So the book of Luke, the biggest book in the New Testament, very important book, unique material in there found in none of the other gospel accounts. And of course, the book of Acts, which is entirely unique. And we talked when we started Acts about how crucial this book is to understanding the New Testament. Well, a few days later, Felix came back with his wife, Drusilla, who was a Jewish. Sending for Paul, they listened as he told them about faith in Christ Jesus. So this isn't a trial. They just want to hear about this concept. And it sounds like Felix, he says he was well aware of the way, was well familiar with it. So maybe others had shared with him the gospel, the truth about Jesus. As Paul reasoned with them about righteousness and self-control and the coming day of judgment, Felix became frightened. Go away for now, he replied. When it's more convenient, I'll call you again. Isn't that interesting? Felix became frightened. Why would you get scared listening to somebody putting up a defense for Christianity? It really doesn't say. The word here means he trembled. This was getting to him somehow. I think I know what it is. I thoroughly believe that what happened here is that Felix hit one of these spots where, as he was listening to the case that Paul was laying out, he started to get this, you get this feeling that, oh my God, you know, I think this might be true. I think it is true. And it's scary. Well, it's scary for me. Because you're like, okay, now what am I going to do? It's like, if your plans conflict with the idea of like believing and following Christ, now you've got a quandary. Am I going to start deliberately practicing self-deception now? Am I going to enter into a life of intellectual dishonesty with myself? Or am I going to completely change my, plans for life and admit that I have a leader here that I didn't even have before? And people don't like either one of those choices, and they get scared. That's what happened to Felix. He says, I'll call for you when it's more convenient. Well, I've seen a lot of people actually reach this point, this very point where Felix is at here. And you, it kind of passes over their face as they start to like, oh my God, I didn't realize there was that much backing for this. And then they, then there's kind of this, you know, panicky, whoa. And away they go. Till a more convenient time. Also, he was hoping Paul would bribe him, so he sent for him quite often and talked. But he's keeping everything at arm's length. He just wants to talk about it. He don't want to do anything about it. After 2 years went by in this way, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. And because Felix wanted to gain favor with the Jewish people, he left Paul in prison. A lot of times when Roman procurators or governors left their office, they would free prisoners that were ambiguous or had served some time. But he left him in, turned him over to Festus. And so Felix passes out of the story at this point. 2 years. That's so now 2 years of completely just wasted time. Paul sitting around talking to this guy that doesn't, this has no intention of following anything he says. Boy, that must have been frustrating. I would die in that situation. I hate just waiting around for things. Chapter 25. 3 days after Festus arrived. So here's the new governor in Caesarea to take over his responsibilities. He left for Jerusalem, where the leading priests and the other Jewish leaders met him and made their accusations against Paul. They're like, you got that guy down there still, and we want to get him. We want him dead. And so they asked Festus as a favor to transfer Paul to Jerusalem, planning to ambush and kill him on the way. I don't know whether Luke knows that for certain or whether he's like, you know, nothing had changed. So probably they still were ready to do that. But they weren't wanting him transferred to Jerusalem for his own safety. Let's put it that way. But Festus replied, look, Paul's at Caesarea and I'm also at Caesarea. So if you want to deal with him, you're coming there. Those of you in authority can return with me. If Paul's done anything wrong, you can make your accusations. About 8 or 10 days later, Festus returned to Caesarea, and on the following day, he took his seat in the court and ordered that Paul be brought in. Another trial. When Paul arrived, the Jewish leaders from Jerusalem gathered around and made many serious accusations that they couldn't prove, probably similar to the last time. Paul denied the charges. I am not guilty of any crime against the Jewish laws or the temple or against the Roman government, he said. Well, Festus, wanting to please the Jews, asked him, are you willing to go to Jerusalem and stand trial before me there? We'll stage your formal trial in Jerusalem. Paul said, no, this is the official Roman court here, so I ought to be tried right here. You know very well I'm not guilty of harming the Jews. If I've done something worthy of death, I don't refuse to die. But if I'm innocent, no one has a right to turn me over to these men to kill me. I appeal to Caesar. In saying this, he spoke an official, this is a specific Latin phrase, caesarem appello, that every Roman citizen had the right to say, I appeal to Caesar, unless, as long as they were not accused of first-degree murder, kidnapping, or something else to which this did not apply. But anything other than those, you were a Roman citizen, I appeal to Caesar. It means I appeal to have Caesar hear my case and decide on it. Well, Festus conferred with his advisors and comes walking back out. He's like, very well, you've appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you will go. A few days later then, one final part of this story, before he leaves, King Agrippa arrived with his sister Bernice to pay their respects to Festus. Okay, this is Herod Agrippa II. This is the guy that killed James, the son of Zebedee, that arrested Peter and threw him in jail. That was this guy's dad. That was Herod Agrippa I. Then there's Herod the Great, the Herod that tried to kill Jesus when he was a baby. Different guy. There's a fourth Herod, if you can believe that. the Herod that put Jesus, that wanted to see a miracle from Jesus when he got crucified and tried to say, walk on water or do something here. That's yet a fourth Herod. So there's four different Herods to deal with. This guy, okay, first time he shows up in the Bible, during their stay of several days, Festus discussed Paul's case with the king. Here, there's a prisoner here, he told him, whose case was left for me by Felix. When I was in Jerusalem, the leading priests and Jewish elders pressed charges against him and asked me to condemn him. I pointed out to them that Roman law does not convict people without a trial. They must be given the opportunity to confront their accusers and defend themselves. When his accusers came here for the trial, I didn't delay. I called the case the very next day and ordered Paul brought in. But the accusations made against him weren't of any of the crimes I expected. Instead, it was something about their religion and a dead man named Jesus, who Paul insists is alive. Some guy that's dead, and Paul says, no, he's not. You can tell he's completely clueless. To this day, 2 years in, the Romans still have no idea what's going on here. And one of the things you can see, because of how difficult it was from their cultural setting to grasp, you know, what was going on, you realize how a brief like Luke Acts would really play well and be very necessary for guys from this perspective. They don't understand who Jesus is or anything that he did. They would need all of that explained. And they would need then the history of Paul and his doings explained, exactly what Luke and Acts do. So you see why this is yet another one of these cases where you realize that the theory that Luke and Acts were written as legal briefs, that this Theophilus that he writes to is Paul's attorney, who needs to understand more than this guy does, some dead guy that Paul thinks is still alive. Well, he says, I was at a loss to know how to investigate these things. So I asked him whether he would be willing to stand trial on these charges in Jerusalem. But Paul appealed to have his case decided by the emperor, so I ordered that he be held in custody till I could arrange to send him to Caesar. I'd like to hear the man myself, Agrippa said. And Festus replied, you will, tomorrow. So the next day, Agrippa and Bernice arrived in the auditorium with great pomp, accompanied by the military officers and prominent men of the city. Festus ordered that Paul be brought in. This isn't exactly a trial. It's more of just a fact-finding thing. Festus gets up and introduces the case. He says, King Agrippa, all who are there, hear this man whose death is demanded by all the Jews, both here and in Jerusalem. But in my opinion, he has done nothing deserving death. However, since he appealed his case to the emperor, I've decided to send him to Rome. But what am I going to write to the emperor? There's no clear charge against him. Actually, there were three very clear charges. He's not lacking in charges. He's lacking in evidence for those charges. But he doesn't really understand the case. That's part of the problem. And he says, I brought him before all of you, and especially you, King Agrippa, so that after we examine him, I might have something to write. It makes no sense to send a prisoner to the emperor without specifying the charges against him. Chapter 26. Then Agrippa says to Paul, you may speak in your defense. Paul gets up. He starts his story, gesturing with his hand, started with his depressed. With his defense, and as the Jewish leaders are well aware, I was given a thorough juris training from my earliest child. He starts telling his life story. It's exactly the same story that we heard last week that he gave in front of the rioters. It's exactly the same as is given by in chapter 9, that he grew up and how he was going and persecuting the Christians, and then Jesus himself confronted him. Paul was a vicious anti-Christian. Until on the road to Damascus, this light comes down and it's Jesus. And he's like, oh my God, I've been wrong the whole time. So he tells that whole story. With one little difference, he adds something that hasn't come up before. When he gets to the part where Jesus says, Saul, why are you persecuting me? There was another thing that Jesus said, which is, it's hard for you to kick against the goads. And a very interesting, so that was also stated there. The goads, on an ox cart, you know, you would have this thing that hung down. Especially this was important with young oxen that weren't trained to a yoke. They wouldn't like having a yoke on them, and they would kick and try to get out of there. And so they would hang these goads down there, which was a stick with barbs on it. If the oxen kicked, they would hit that and pretty quickly learn that's not a good idea. Kicking against the goads, the more you kick against it, the more it hurts you. And this is the analogy Jesus hits Paul with. Why was Paul so ferocious against Christians? Why was Paul such a bloodthirsty slayer, a beater, a torturer of Christians? It was because he was kicking against the goads. That Paul's real problem was his underlying suspicion, probably dating all the way back to his first victim, Stephen, that this might all be true. That's what was galling Paul, is that he was trying to suppress something that he suspected was really true after all. And so, I'm not going to read his whole speech again because we're trying to move through a lot of passages here, but he concludes with this. He says, I teach nothing except what the prophets and Moses said would happen. And so what Paul is going to, you know, again, reading between the lines of what he's probably teaching here, he's going to teach the way he always did, which was to demonstrate from the Old Testament scriptures themselves that Jesus was who he said he was, the authenticity of Jesus. He says, what do they predict? First, that the Messiah would suffer. Yes, that is predicted, actually, in the Old Testament. He may very well be referring to passages like if Isaiah 53, he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people to whom the stroke was due. So he didn't die for his own reasons, but rather that his death was a substitution. He died for the transgressions of my people. It's the whole Old Testament notion of the innocent substituting for the guilty in judgment. It's exactly what Jesus did at the cross, predicted ahead of time. This book of Isaiah is from 700 BC. And you know, we actually have a full copy of this book, the oldest scroll of the Old Testament, reliably dated to 200 BC or earlier, today on display in the Jerusalem Museum. And it's got this verse right there. He's cut off out of the land of the living. That he's killed. His grave was assigned to be with wicked men. Well, yet he was with a rich man in his death. That's an interesting little riddle there. And yet, ironically, literally fulfilled in Jesus, when he, as a crucifixion victim, should have been flipped into the common grave with the rest of the criminals. But instead, that wealthy man, Joseph of Arimathea, went and bribed Pilate to give him the body of Jesus, and he laid it in a hewn, unused tomb, something only the rich could afford. That's interesting. And it says, yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and to cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, that's the animal. One of the types of animal sacrifice was the guilt offering, where you're guilty and you offer an animal sacrifice, and it symbolically, like, he dies instead of you. So, of course, an animal can't really substitute for a person. They're just animals. They don't even have moral categories at all. This was all symbolic. This was all teaching what God would really do to substitute for sin when he sent Jesus, when he sent his own son. And so that's all predicted in the Old Testament. And he says, the Old Testament says that he will rise from the dead Yeah, he could probably keep writing right here. He will see his offspring. He will prolong his days. And the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. He just said he was dead and buried. And now all of a sudden God will prolong his days. And the Messiah would suffer, that he would be the first to rise from the dead. And that in this way announce God's light to the Jews and the Gentiles alike. A crucial point, which is that God, after the coming of Messiah, would really break out of the national, you know, confines of Israel and make and go out into the world, the whole world. A statement also probably maybe alluding to this in Isaiah 42 verse 6, where God says to his servant, I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you. I will appoint you as a covenant to the people and a light to the nations. Almost word to word, word for word. This is what Paul's referring to right here, Isaiah 42. It's another one of the anonymous servant songs in Isaiah that refer to the work of Jesus. That's what he's doing, is he's going right down through. And so he is really bringing them into the heart of the gospel itself here. He's explaining the good news, which is that, look, every one of us here deserves to come under the judgment of God. Every one of us is guilty enough. There's none of us that have not sinned. None of us are free of sin. And so we're guilty and we need a guilt offering. We're either going to have to come and stand before God and face his judgment. We don't want to be in that position. Okay? That would not be a good position to be in. Or, because of the great love of God, we can let him provide a substitute. And he takes essentially his judgment upon himself, the guilt offering, which is the Messiah. He's making it clear what God has done and there and what right at that moment. Suddenly, Festus shouted, Paul, you're out of your mind. Your great learning's driving you insane. That's a great time for him to suddenly bust his cork. Just as we're getting down to the punchline of this whole thing here. And so Paul comes back. He says, I am not insane, most excellent Festus. What I'm saying is the sober truth. And King Agrippa knows about these things. See, now Agrippa, unlike Festus, who's a Roman, Agrippa has grown up right there in Israel. He's married to an Israelite. Agrippa himself was kind of, he was half Edomitean, half Jewish. He knew the scriptures. So as Paul was reciting these things, he's like checking them off one by one. And Paul says, King Agrippa, you do believe the prophets. I know you do. And Agrippa comes back and says, in a short time, you'll persuade me to become a Christian. Well, this is actually this statement. Some of your translations read differently on this verse. There's actually two ways to take this verse. One is that Agrippa is scoffing. He's either saying, oh, I'm sure you think that you can win me over to Christ in such a short time. That's possible to read it that time, that way. And I think NLT, for instance, translates it that way. Do you think you can win me in such a short time to believe to become a Christian? The other way to take it is that he's saying, you've almost persuaded me to become a Christian, which is the way most translations have it. And I'm inclined to think, and that's been the general way that most people take it, the second one, that he's saying, you know, I'm blown away, like you've almost persuaded me to become, almost persuaded. Well, Paul said, I would wish to God that whether in a short or a long time, not only you, but all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except for these chains. And so he's saying, you guys should believe in what I'm saying. He calls them to faith here. Well, they went out. As they went out, they talked it over and they agreed. This man hasn't done anything to deserve death or imprisonment. And Agrippa said to Festus, he could have been set free if he hadn't appealed to Caesar. Well, that's easy for him to say. Actually, if Festus had set Paul free, for one thing, he probably would have been dead within an hour or two once he got outside of that fortress. And even if Festus made sure he got away, he could have had a revolt on his hands. It would have been very hard for him to let Paul go. And I don't know. It hadn't happened for the past 2 years, and I wonder if it ever would have happened. So anyway, Paul had appealed to Caesar. And so at this point, finally, after 2 years of wrangling, Festus does arrange for him to take ship, and Luke goes with him. It's another one of these we passages that we've seen in the book of Acts, and they sail for Rome. On the voyage, there's all these adventures that they go through and stuff, and it turns out that's another couple or three chapters there, so we'll just drop the story right here for now. Think about if you were Paul sitting there for these 2 years, imprisoned, you've done nothing wrong, a man of action. Paul, you know, was probably at the zenith of his ability, his scholarship, his experience. This guy was planting early, you know, house churches everywhere he went. And here during this whole time, you know, nobody believes, no, you know, new groups planted. There's no sign of anything good. Maybe he reached some people to faith. I don't know. Not very few. Maybe some guards or something. But this would have been agonizing to spend this much time doing virtually nothing, next to nothing. Little or no visible fruit being born. Of course, we look back at it today and it looks very different. Because it's during this period that these two crucial books in the New Testament. Remember when we started Acts, I said, imagine reading the New Testament without Acts. You end with the story of Jesus in Israel with his Jewish followers, and you'd turn the page and it would be Romans 1. You're reading a letter to a group of people in Rome, Gentiles, from some dude named Paul that never showed up in the story before. I mean, you know, it would just be insane. Theology that's completely gone to a new level that was never seen in the Gospels. The whole New Testament would just be like two different books, unrelated almost, except for the references to Jesus. And it's Acts that is that linchpin that shows us how God moved from the Old Covenant to the New and everything that he had done and bridges the way for the rest of it. I mean, this is a crucial, crucial book. So, but the killer is, if you were there at the time, I'm sure Paul felt like, you know, it's probably a good idea to write this. They may have been writing it for different reasons. I mean, there's a very good chance that they were writing this as material to be used in Paul's defense. They couldn't have felt like it was that important. But today, and for all of the centuries since then, Christians have depended on this for our basic understanding of what the message is all about. It turns out this may have been two of the most important years in Paul's life, just because of that writing that they did. These trials that he went through, of course, we saw how he was trying to use them as an opportunity to declare the good news. When Jesus called him in chapter 9, he says, I'm going to have you go in and testify before kings and nobles and, you know, high powers, which he did. And he's talking to various governors, the king Agrippa, the high priest, and next comes Caesar himself. He's going to speak in front of Caesar. And we find when we read Philippians 1, where he's sitting now in Rome waiting for his trial before Caesar, he says, pray that I don't chicken out, and then I let him have it right between the eyes with the truth. He's planning to walk into the presence of Caesar himself and declare the gospel. Well, as he tries to get the gospel out in these trials, he gets reactions from people that I notice are not unusual. In fact, we still get some of these kind of reactions today when we talk to people about our faith. First, there was the Sanhedrin. They never considered for a single moment whether anything he said might possibly be true. I mean, it was just a rampage, you know. You know, he no sooner opened his mouth and they're like, you know, slap him in the face. I mean, this was a murderous rage that came out. And, you know, you'll still see this to this day. And it, so much rage, it really makes you wonder, you know, because it's like anything else I talked about wouldn't create this kind of anger. If I busted out with my Buddhist beliefs, people would just be like, oh, man, that's really far out. Sweet, cool. And all of a sudden you say something about Jesus and and there's this big reaction, you know, and it's like, I said, no one else gets that reaction. Kind of makes you wonder. But that's been happening down through history. Then there was Felix. Felix, he got scared. Remember? That he hit that point where he, the only way he would get scared, I mean, he was the governor. Paul was just a guy in chains, you know. So, I mean, why would he be scared? He's scared because of something happening inside of him, on himself. That's when the Holy Spirit of God comes and he's kind of like goading you and saying, hey, you, this, what he's saying, true. You need to follow. And you're like, he got scared. His reaction, he decided to wait until a more convenient time. Something I've seen. Yeah, I've seen this happen. This is where somebody's like, yeah, well, I think I might do this later. But, you know, the funny thing is, you wait for that convenient time. I've even had people tell me before. I've had quite a few people say, you know, I'm really feeling like this is truth. I feel like what you're saying is actually true. And I'm like, all right. So you're ready then? No, I'm not. Why? I don't know. I'm just not feeling it yet. I don't feel right about it. And there's a sense that at a certain point, I'm just going to feel it, you know, and I'm going to like, it'll just happen or whatever. And it's like, folks, that time may never come, okay? God expects us to take a step of faith toward him. And it may feel uncomfortable. We may be feeling like, well, I'm not feeling it right now. This isn't convenient right now. But if we wait for a convenient time, that time may never come. It may never come. And we miss the opportunity to have that substitute, to have our sins swept away, to be accepted by God, to have him actually come into our lives. Miss it. Then there was Agrippa. Agrippa's the guy who says, I'm almost persuaded. Another kind of sad epithet, you know. Happens a lot. Not too unusual. Again, I've talked to so many people who are like, I'm almost there. It's like I'm seeing all the parts. But the fact of the matter is, to be almost persuaded, not good enough. It's also necessary then to take a step. You know, it's like there's a line here, and I need to step over that line and say, God, I'm willing. And this is where we can hesitate right at that point where I'm starting to get the feeling that this is true. I feel like God might even be working in my life. You know, I'm getting the feeling that I have this inner, like, call, this need that I'm sensing. But you can be scared like Felix was, but there's a point where you step over the line and you're not saying, okay, I believe everything, but you're saying, I'm willing. You're saying to God, if this is real, bring it and show me that it's real. And God's cool with that. He'll go with that. That's all he wants. He's not going to ram it down your throat unwillingly. He wants you to say, I am willing, and then he'll bring it, and he'll show you the rest of the story. Finally, for those of us that have already made that decision and are Christians, another passage that's good to ponder in connection with this whole story, Isaiah 54:17, where he says, God says, no weapon that is formed against you will prosper, and every tongue that accuses you in judgment you will condemn. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord, and their vindication is from me. And so we see how continually these efforts are being made to kill Paul. You know, but then, you know, like his nephew just happens to hear the conversation, and that worked out pretty well. You know, it's like, it wasn't going to happen. Doesn't matter who wanted Paul dead. God was saying, now I want him alive. I'm not done with this guy yet. And we'll learn as we go on that when you're a servant of the Lord, you don't need to worry about what other people are going to do. Because God's got everything under control. He's not going to let you get wasted. I mean, they might put the hurt on you. They did that on him. You know, they were beating him and stuff. I'm sure it hurt. But they couldn't waste him. Every weapon fashioned against you will not prosper. And God will keep. And so there's a wonderful sense of not needing to be anxious. If you're a servant of the Lord, we're able to entrust ourselves to him. And nothing's going to happen to us that's outside of his plan. We don't need to worry about it. And I know people that are so afflicted with anxiety and worry about, man, what if my brakes go out? Man, what if this, what if I catch this disease? So on and so forth. And they're always worried and anxious. We don't need to be that way. We have God, as since we've committed our direction to him, he'll take care of us right down at the end, just like he did Paul. And there you have 22 through 26 partway of Acts.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.